You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Christoph Heinrich. He is the Frederick and Jan Mayer Director of the Denver Art Museum. Christoph, thanks so much for being with us today.
Oh, happy to be here.
So to begin with, the Denver Art Museum, you know, in my mind, is a spectacular space with, the Frederick Hamilton building and the spaces and how they're built there seem just extraordinary. It must be a pleasure to direct that museum.
Actually, I love to hear that. Yes, it is a pleasure. And both buildings, we have this buildings from the 60s, early 70s by the Italian designer Joe Ponti, which is an architectural jewel. And as you say, the new Libeskind building, which was inaugurated, I think, 7 years ago, is a wonderful building and very special, very unique. And it's great, actually, to work with both.
Yeah, I mean, the Libeskind building is you know, iconic and seems futuristic. The Ponti, though, feels, not almost more modernist, but there's something about it that seems entirely unusual, almost like the Gaudi building in Barcelona. And I know it's nothing like it, but it's so unusual and is so, it looks extraordinary. It's huge also.
Yeah, actually it is. It's very classy. And it gives us an enormous amount of exhibition space. That's something I'm really proud of, and it's just a relatively recent survey that found out that the Denver Art Museum is number 4 in the country in terms of the amount of real estate that we dedicate to our permanent collections. So, of course, it's the Met, it's the Art Institute, it's the MFA in Boston, and then it's us in this rank. So for a city the size of Denver, that is quite something. And I think that is due to the fact that the Ponti building has a very smart, very wonderful layout of real estate, very efficient. And then the new building, the Daniel Libeskind building, brings the drama and the flexibility and the unexpected spaces that are everything but classic.
Yes, and you know, it's interesting you were saying how there's, you know, fourth in the amount of space that you have to display works, because so often museums, especially in New York now, have a very limited amount of space in a lot of big cities, and the collections are mostly unseen. Is that correct? I would think the majority of museum collections aren't seen, where we're looking at a fraction of what's on the walls.
I think that is probably the case with pretty much every museum that is an actively collecting museum, that you cannot show everything. And for instance, at the Denver Art Museum, there are probably about 10% on show of our permanent collection. So we have more than 70,000 objects, and I would say it's probably about 7,000 objects that are, 7,000 to 8,000 objects that are on show at any given time. But we swap a lot. We change a lot. We give out loans, and that gives us the opportunity to organize a gallery new, or we focus on a certain topic and then find wonderful things in the storage and in the archives. So I think, there's sometimes this sadness that you can't see or you can't show everything, but on the other hand, you always have these great treasure troves, and then you find things that haven't been on show for a while, and you get really excited about it. And just to give you an example, right now we're doing a wonderful show, Corto Café, which is 300 years of French art. And we pulled out maybe 12, 15 decorative art objects from our own collection. And one of them was an 18th century sedan chair, which is a pretty rare thing because these things where the aristocrats were carried around through Paris in, they all were burned in the French Revolution, so there are not many around anymore. And we have one, and it
Wow.
looked lousy because nobody ever looked at it. We found it in storage, and it was there, and it was always in the inventory, but nobody ever did something with it. So now several conservators treated it. They looked at it. They conserved it. They did touch-ups. They cleaned it. They mended the fabric, which was pretty terrible. And now the thing looks stunning and is wonderful and tells really a story about life in the 18th century in Paris.
Amazing. And you're an actively acquiring museum and you're building collections. Are those are there contemporary collections? Are you buying from living artists as well?
Yeah, actually, it's an encyclopedic museum in the great American tradition of encyclopedic museums. And for me as a German, this was a strong appeal. This was really one of the reasons why I wanted to work here, because in Germany everything is very specialized. I mean, you have the anthropological museum, you have the Asian museum, you have the museum for contemporary art, et cetera, et cetera. And here you have the whole world under one roof. So we have a significant, wonderful Asian collection. We have one of the best collection of pre-Columbian art and Spanish colonial art in the world outside of Mexico. We have a great contemporary collection, which is growing, but we have as well some more exotic things, like a beautiful oceanic collection or great photography collection that we just started a few years ago with its own curator. I mean, photography has been collected before, but that this was really perceived as its own collecting area is relatively new for us. So this diversity of medium, but as well of cultures under one roof, I think that makes it really exciting, and of course that makes as well working in a museum like this so exciting, because you always can connect different departments and you always have material from all parts of the world at hand.
And it seems almost an impossible task to be acquiring for a museum like that. How do you know where and when to acquire it? On one hand, I would think having unusual objects like you're talking about, which make it extraordinary and so unique to have in your museum, how do you make the balance between contemporary art or living artists and the encyclopedic amount of other collections and new collections I imagine you'd want to build?
I mean, you rely really heavily on the expertise of your curators, and the curators are as well, I would say, the hands or the minds that form a certain collection. So, for instance, we have an Asian curator who is really an expert in Japanese art. So, over the last decades where he was working for the museum, he was able to pull together a wonderful Japanese collection. Japanese lacquerware and Japanese works on paper, and so there is an expertise, and of course you can't do everything. You have certain areas, certain strengths, and I would say moving forward, you probably always try to strengthen the strength and not necessarily to do everything.
Right. And when you're working with contemporary, how the curator for acquiring contemporary work, how is that managed? Because there's also, an enormous amount of contemporary artists all over the world. How does the museum select that?
I think here as well, there is a certain individual hand that comes in and a certain interest that somebody might have and might look for more painterly work, for more abstract work or formal politically engaged work. Or I think the contemporary collection that we are building up over the last years is getting stronger and stronger in extending the materials, extending the palette of materials that artists are using. So we acquired works by Shinnick Smith, who paints with fabric, with textiles, or by Leonardo Drew, who works with a variety of different found woods, or Ernesto Neto, who does these soft sculptures. So I think it's as well, really, that you build these clusters, and then an artist might make sense in that cluster, but as well, another artist you might just not acquire because it would be a unique thing that you couldn't really show with anything else.
Sure. Okay, let's move back a little bit. I'd love to hear your beginnings when, as a child, teenager, or whatever age you want to start. What is it that drew you to the art world or got you involved in even thinking that the arts were important?
Me personally?
Yeah, you personally.
Wow. I always wanted to do something in the arts. I mean, it took a while, actually, until I knew I would work in a museum. I always thought I would work as a stage director in theater, or as, I don't know, I had tons of ideas. But I think art played always a role in my life, and that was either theater or music or painting or something. And in hindsight,
and you grew up in Germany, correct?
Yes, I'm German. I grew up in the area of Frankfurt, and my mother is an opera singer, or was an opera singer. She doesn't sing anymore, but she used to, and music, of course, was a big part of, and particularly opera was a big part of me being a kid. And my dad is a chemist and a scientist, and I always was much more drawn to the arts and to literature and books and stuff that my mother would offer me than to science, which I probably didn't really care very much enough, very much about. And since I had two brothers who cared very much about engineering and that sort of stuff, I kind of had the free choice to do things that I love to do.
Well, that's, you know, in my mind, I was born here, an American, and it always seems to me that the arts in Europe, in Germany, but in a lot of parts of Europe are much more integrated into daily life than they are here. Did you find that as a kid growing up, or do you see the difference now, or is that my own myth about Europe?
Might be a little bit of a myth, I think, because it really depends on what your family does. I think actually one thing that I really realized early on and that made me as well work here is I think the museums are much more open, much more engaged, much more interactive than any museum in Germany. And they're more inviting. They have far more innovative programs. They do much more in terms of education than any museum that I would know of in Europe. And I always thought that's an important step, how you make these things attractive to people that might not have had them at home or might not been grown up with them.
Well, that's important because that's really about kind of cultural and visual literacy, isn't it? Because this is a, you know, how people often, I was just talking with an art advisor today about this notion that some people feel they come into a museum of modern art or a variety of kinds of museums and think, I don't understand anything here. And there's often a reaction from critics or even people to kind of push back and say, well, you know, then maybe it's not good art, or it's, you know, because there's a lack of understanding. Is that what you're talking about, a kind of encouraging by making it look attractive, creating an opening for cultural literacy, if you will, to understand?
I would think so, yes, and making it accessible and making the step to bring it to the people and to open it up for discussion or to make it fun to explore it. And I think just to give you an example, we did for the second time here in Denver something which I'm very proud and very happy about, and that is a campus-wide exhibition where all the curatorial departments participated, and which in fact was more like 10 or 12 different exhibitions which were laid out like a scavenger hunt. The first one was called Marvelous Mud, and it was everything about clay all around the world and through the cultures and through the ages. And the second one this year was called Spun, and it was about textiles, adventures in textiles. And initially you would think, well, textiles, that's maybe something for the ladies and for people that sit down and do knitting and do crafts things. But then you realize, wow, there are a lot of really interesting contemporary artists that are working with textiles and that are really redefining fabric and textile softness, exploring the qualities of a material. And then suddenly you realize, wow, actually in history, textile was a communicator because it was easy to carry around. So it connected the Far East with the European merchants in the 16th century. And it brought pattern from the most remote parts of the world into the centers of the European cultures at that time. So you realize this material, which you and your little ignorant perception, or me and my little ignorant perception in that case, really cubbyholed into one corner, and you realize there's enormous potential in this, and there's great stories to tell about it, and there are wonderful things to explore about it, and it has really nothing to do with just leisure work for some people. It is much more, and it is a great part of the most diverse cultures, be it Asian, be it African, be it European, be it Far East, Near East, Middle East, whatever. And that is really exciting. And I think this is something that people love to explore, and they love as well to be surprised. So one of the shows was a wonderful show with works by the Chicago artist Nick Cave. And he does these performances, great performances, for which he creates costumes. So his background is been a dancer with Alvin Ailey, and his background is performance. But he started to do these wild costumes which make sounds and which integrate all sorts of objects. So these are ways to explore material and to extend your perception of material, and I think that is a wonderful role if a museum can do this, and that is certainly something that we want to do in all our shows and all our programming.
Well, that's also a wonderful way. Nick Cave, of course, I know the artist, and he recently had a performance in Grand Central Station in New York.
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
And maybe those are some of the costumes that you're talking about or that look similar, that are filled with color and all kinds of things hanging off them, and they look like, you know, animals and objects. And
yeah.
just wonderful feeling to them. What's powerful also about what you're saying, though, is people are not only introduced to this notion of how the art and medium has grown through the ages, but it brings it right up to contemporary artists. So you understand the history that Nick Cave is, in a sense, referencing and being a part of. And though we don't think of him maybe as a typical fiber artist or however it's discussed in terms of artists,
but
who are
probably
using.
He probably would kick me in the butt if I would call him a fiber artist. So I think
right.
That's certainly not a, I mean, that is as well, artists don't like to be pigeonholed, and which is a good thing, I think, because that keeps themselves out of certain corners or holes. And I think just the choice for one material does not necessarily make an artist a specialist in that material. So that's certainly something to explore. But what you just said about the cultural references or the historical references, and that's, I think, where an encyclopedic museum comes in very handy, because one floor above, or two floor above in that case, we have a small but nice African collection of African art. And there are a couple of costumes which really are kind of reference material or inspirational to the work of Nick Cave. And he probably would totally admit this, that there are certain tribal arts, African art, oceanic art, that he looks at or that he gets inspirations from, but then, of course, transfers it into a very contemporary form and very contemporary costumes that are as well fashion and have as well some of the boldest Alexander McQueen like creations, or who's the guy with the striped shirt that I can't think of right now? French.
Gautier?
Gautier, yes. Jean-Paul Gautier. And that is a very interesting. I mean, I think a lot of artists are working now in this more fluid zone between fashion, sculpture, performance, you name it. And that makes very interesting art.
Well, it's also fascinating to hear how the vision of the museum talks about the influence of artists. I mean, I was thinking of also, you know, Picasso and Braque and so many who were influenced by African sculpture
sure.
and different types of art. But to see how artists do that also, you know, right up to Nick Cave, puts it in a context where I would imagine the public would understand or begin to understand that artists aren't creating these sculptures or images simply in their studio the way someone, you know, may make a plein air painting. They're really referencing and looking at an enormous amount of history. I mean, not that plein air painting doesn't also do that, but a contemporary artist who's running between mediums, as Nick Cave is, it seems to me that that would be fascinating to the public to understand where contemporary artists are coming from in regard to all their references.
And Nick was incredibly generous about this. I mean, he did a public lecture, and he did several performances actually with people here in the community and dancers, and was really sharing a lot of his ideas and background, and is a great artist to work in the community with.
It's really wonderful hearing this from you and understanding the role of the museum for myself, but also for the listeners, in terms of its creating a context for artists, contemporary artists as well, referencing history and really teaching the audience something about how to access art.
And is quite honestly, I think really there is a change of paradigm happened. There has a change of paradigm happened in the last maybe 10 years, maybe 12 years, probably not much longer, where the museum really developed from the place where things were just archived and exposed and put on the wall and put in vitrines to a much more connected community place with a lot of activities, with a lot of interactive things as well, really a trigger of creativity, which goes far beyond the idea of how did Klaus Oldenburg say in the 60s? The museum is the place where his sculptures are just sitting on their ass or something. There's a
Right.
wonderful Klaus Oldenburg quote from the 60s, but I just can't think of it right now. So that boring place, and I don't know whether the museum was ever that boring, but I know that now the museum is really much more and has many different layers and many different roles to fill as well in the community and is connecting people and is a place for all sorts of creativity and of networking and of meeting people and communicating with people and finding a common ground of certain things, but as well, I think a place where things get discussed and explored, and so it's a much more hybrid place than this idea of just things that sit on their pedestal and don't do much.
And that's very exciting news, really, for contemporary artists, because the paradigm is not museum, as a friend of mine once said, as mausoleum, but it's a dynamic place where there's so much interaction happening. And I would think for contemporary artists, this also creates many, many openings in terms of public workshops and exhibitions and creating interactive events. Is that true? I mean, that contemporary artists now also have a more active role, whether they're young and emerging or older and emerging or almost at any stage?
Absolutely, absolutely. I think that is totally the case. And the museum has actually became as well I'm lacking a word here, the commissioner of projects. We did a show a few years ago, which was called Embrace, and we commissioned 17 artists to do new pieces on site, specifically for a certain situation. And that was, of course, had to do with the great opportunity of the Hamilton Building, which offers grand walls that goes over four floors, as much as little funny granny little nooks somewhere, little corners in some areas. So you have it all, and it is very appealing to artists, which made us do this project and 17 new artworks that we actually really realized. We put money not so much into shipping, but really in realizing new artworks were done for the show. And these were wall paintings and vinyls and big installations. Jessica Stockholder did a wonderful large installation for one of the exhibition spaces. And Lawrence Wiener did a great wall piece. And Kristen Baker and some European artists, and Tobias Rehberger did a maze of bungee cords. And so these were all new works, and I think that the museum really triggers these new work, is helping to realize new work. That is a new role. That's not really what museums did 20, 30 years ago, or rarely did. And this is much more, I think, the present and the future. By the way, I found the Klaus Oldenburg quote, and it says, "I'm for an art that is political, erotical, mystical, that does something more than sit on its ass in a museum." So, this notion that a museum is something where things sit on their ass and don't do much, I think that really has changed over the last 50 years. So it's a quote from the 60s. I hope Oldenburg has changed his idea of museums as well in the next
world. I'm sure he has, and Lord, I hope so, because it's true, so many things were changing in the 60s that, you know, with museums bringing in video and performance and being open to new artists, and now, as you're saying, this very interactive state. Is there also a different element to public education and in terms of workshops and artists directly working with the public and engaging, whether it's children in hands-on things, but also adults in activities that are...
Absolutely. I mean, and I think that is as well something that we really put front and center. We started a space which is called the Studio Space about 2, maybe 3 years ago, and that's not somewhere in the basement or in the backyard. It's right in the center of the main hall, and it's a drop-in studio. So you can, whenever you visit the museum, come in and try out something, do something. There are certain activities. It's staffed. And right now, for the Paris show, it's a drawing studio. So teaches you all sorts about academic drawing, but as well about a more experimental drawing and all sorts of innovative material to draw. During the Yves Saint Laurent retrospective, it was a fashion studio with a little catwalk, and people were doing all sorts of wild things with textiles and did their own haute couture creations. Or during Marvelous Mud, it was a ceramic studio, and you could really try out your luck on a real potter's wheel and could actually see how darn difficult it is to make a pot. I mean, I never believed it. But so these things, I think, became as well part of the central mission of a museum. They might have been before something that a museum would have done as well, and you would have maybe signed up for a class in advance. But now we really try to promote this and put it front and center and make the opportunity to try out these things, give people the opportunity to try this out.
That's very exciting to hear. I wish I'd been closer to your museum. You know, in one thing I want to ask, I think perhaps in closing, is this is exciting for artists to listen to of all ages. Some artists, of course, you know, already understand the dynamic of the museum, but I think the way you've talked about it and the way, in particular, your museum is become so interactive, and especially with contemporary artists and all the projects you just described. Is there something you want to say to artists who are listening to this, who are thinking, that sounds exciting, I'd like to get involved or present proposals? How does, or you can speak to something else, but I'm thinking, how does the contemporary artist in your mind, be they emerging or more well-known, get involved in some of the dynamic ideas that you're presenting at your museum?
I think probably all museums in the country, or most of the museums in the country, really need this living creativity. I mean, it's one thing to go back to artists that have done wonderful things in their time, but it's really another thing to get an idea about what it means to make art. And I think from what we do here, but as well really what I perceive with colleagues all over the country, I think there is the need to interact with artists. And sometimes I'm bumping into this notion, which I really find a little weird, quite honestly, of artists who don't want to know too much, who really think they can act in a void and don't really want to know much about what other artists did before, and think they need the concentration and the focus on their own work to do good work. And that might be right to a certain degree, but on the other hand, you're not in a void. I mean, you are in a time where everything is accessible with a click. So you cannot act or pretend as if there is no art history. And there's so much great stuff done in the last 2,000 years, in the last whatever 3,000 years, and particularly actually in the last century, in the 60s, in the 70s, conceptually and painterly and in many, many different ways. I think it is important to expose yourself to these things, to learn about them, to look at them so that you're not just repeating things or reinventing the wheel on and on, because that, of course, is then usually not terribly inventive or original.
I think that's very important to say, and I think you're certainly not alone in that sentiment and that idea. It was just today I was talking with the art consultant that I mentioned before. It was actually Sherry Pascarella of SLP Consulting in New York, and she talked about the same thing, the notion that artists have to be part of the conversation of what's happening. They have to understand, the other painters, sculptors, installation artists that they may be interested in and are drawing from, as well as the artists that have come before them. So you can see your place in history and most importantly, add to the literal conversation of ideas that are being shared and used and reused and added to in so many different ways.
And I think that you're totally spot on, and I think that's really as well where this maybe old role, but renewing and constantly reinventing role of the museum comes in as a memory of what was, and as well a reminder of what is.
Christoph, thank you so much for talking with us today. I'm really grateful for your conversation. I think it was very helpful to our listeners. And personally, I was very, very excited to hear what you had to say about new paradigms and the structure of the museum, and yours in particular.
Okay, thank you very much, Brainerd. Thanks for listening, and come by in Denver. It's actually, we have a lot of airplanes that fly to Denver, and they fly as well back to the East Coast, so, and they almost do this every hour, so.
Okay, well then I look forward to seeing you very soon.
All right. Goodbye, Brainerd.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.